Chapter 1. The Apprentice. Donald Trump's seduction began the way it would continue for years, with flattery, proximity to celebrity and power, and my own out-of-control ambitions and desires. For me, it started on a nondescript day in the fall of 2006. At the time, I was a successful, if little-known, middle-aged Midtown Manhattan attorney and businessman on the make, sitting in a tidy, nondescript office with two of everything arranged before me on my desk, a function of my obsessive nature. Two staplers, two tape dispensers, two phones, two cups with sharpened pencils. I was 39, and I worked for the mid-sized white shoe law firm Phillips Neiser. As a lawyer, I'd long had a busy practice in personal injury and medical malpractice, but my real passion and talent was in deal-making, and I had accumulated a multi-million-dollar fortune in the rough-and-tumble taxi medallion industry. Wealthy, with a beautiful wife and two healthy, happy young children, I had just purchased an apartment in the Trump Park Avenue building for $4.9 million, and I tooled around the city in a Bentley and considered myself semi-retired. I had it made, in other words, but I didn't know that I was on the precipice of a midlife crisis that would lead to an all-consuming fixation and my downfall. On this fall day in 2006, sitting at my desk doing the paper-pushing drone work of practicing the law, my secretary buzzed on the intercom. "It's Donald Trump Jr. on line one," she said. I was half expecting the call. I knew the younger Trump from my recent purchase of three units in the new Trump Park Avenue, a project then under construction to be converted into my family home. Two one-bedroom units and a two-bedroom apartment on the 10th floor of what had been the High Society Delmonico Hotel were being consolidated into a single residence with sweeping views of the iconic avenue from the living room running half the length of the building. Don Jr. was handling the construction job on behalf of the Trump Organization, so we talked often. I picked up the call. News about the Trump Park Avenue, or TPA as insiders knew it, was a welcome distraction from my routine legal work. Besides, I'd become friendly with the younger Trump and enjoyed our banter and shared New York real estate tough guy personas. I had long cultivated the image of a hard ass, the kind of lawyer who could solve any and every kind of problem, not necessarily through my legal acumen, but as a hyper-aggressive, take-no-prisoners fixer, kind of a knock-around version of the TV character Ray Donovan, but in real life. "Hey, D, what's up? How are things going at TPA?" I said. "I'm not calling about TPA," Trump Jr. said. "Can you meet with me and my dad at his office? It's about something else and very important. My dad thinks you could be very helpful." Everything with the Trumps was always very, I would learn, but I didn't hesitate. A meeting with Donald Trump? Hell yeah. I'd met Trump once before a few years earlier at a political fundraiser for a Republican candidate for New York Attorney General, but that had only been in passing. Within minutes, I was walking excitedly up Fifth Avenue towards Trump Tower. To me, the elder Trump wasn't just a celebrity and billionaire real estate developer. As an undergraduate at American University in Washington, D.C., I'd read The Art of the Deal when it was published in the 1980s, not once, but twice, and I considered the book a masterpiece. Ruthless, relentless, insatiable, brilliant, innovative, hard-edged, hard-driving, above all, always a winner. The self-portrait of Trump contained in those pages, however fictional and far from the truth, had enthralled me. Secretly, in my heart of hearts, I thought I possessed some of Trump's best qualities. I saw myself as deal-driven, relentless, a hard worker, never afraid, prepared to be brutal and heartless in pursuit of my ambitions. I already had wealth, but I wanted it all. Power, the good life, public acclaim, fame, big deals, fast cars, private planes, the excess and glamour and zest for life that Trump appeared to personify so effortlessly. Walking up Fifth Avenue, I had an inkling what the meeting might be about. In recent weeks, as Don Jr. and I had discussed progress on the renovation of my TPA apartment, he'd told me about a fight that was brewing at another Trump property in Midtown near the United Nations, this one called Trump World Tower, or TWT. I also owned an investment unit in TWT, which I rented out for $15,000 a month. And I'd encouraged my parents and mother and father-in-law to also buy into the building, meaning that together, my family owned more than half a dozen apartments in the East Side skyscraper that had boasted celebrity residents like Harrison Ford and the New York Yankee Derek Jeter. The 72-story tower, which claims to have 90 floors on the elevator push button, classic Trump, was in turmoil because the condo's board of directors had gotten into a blood feud with Trump the elder about disputed fees and who should get the benefit of a city tax abatement of $100 million. Both the board and Trump had engaged lawyers as the fight grew more and more bitter and personal, the younger Trump had told me. Now the board was trying to remove the Trump name from the building on the grounds that it was more valuable to the owners without the association with the apprentice reality TV star. The threat was not only an affront to the elder Trump, but also a real and serious threat to the brand, and the Trump name was basically all that the Trump organization had left to sell by 2006. If the TWT disassociated itself from Trump, what would happen next? Who else might see the name as a liability? The name Trump was attached to a seemingly endless string of golf courses and products, and any threat to the brand was taken to be existential. I'd sympathized and expressed outrage at the offense to the Trumps, even offering assistance if desired. I believed in the Trump brand and the value it brought to real estate, and that he was rightfully due a payment of nearly $15 million for securing the tax abatement. Don Jr. knew of my reputation as a tough guy attorney, so I figured that was why I'd been called. Entering the revolving doors of Trump Tower with an appointment with the proprietor, I was in awe at the majesty of the famous atrium, the grand escalator, the pink marble walls, the brass of the place, literally and metaphorically. The sheer scale and class of the building were incredible, at least to my way of thinking. The building had been designed to create such an impression, of course, but it worked on me. Presenting myself at the security desk, I was told that Mr. Trump was expecting me. This acknowledgement of my existence by the great man provided a jolt of excitement. Escorted to the 26th floor, headquarters of the Trump operation, I was greeted by a beautiful young blonde woman who also said that Mr. Trump was expecting me, giving me another moment of pleasure. I was immediately ushered through glass doors into a large office with a sweeping view of Fifth Avenue and Central Park. Sitting behind a large, cluttered desk was the elder Trump, talking loudly on a call on speakerphone. To me, the hulking Trump was even larger in life than he appeared on television. His presence filled the room as I surveyed the office, an homage to Trump with a vanity wall boasting scores of magazine covers with Trump's image, along with shelves packed with glass awards and deal mementos and sports memorabilia, including a garish and glittering version of Mike Tyson's heavyweight world champion belt. Three red velvet executive egg chairs were arranged in front of Trump's desk, with Don Jr. seated in one and the chief financial officer of the Trump organization, Alan Weisselberg, in the other. I was directed to sit in the middle seat, where I waited as Trump conducted what seemed to be a private conversation with us all listening in. The call over, Trump yelled out for a Diet Coke, stood, and offered his hand to me. Like all New Yorkers, I had followed Trump in the tabloids for years and knew about his foibles and idiosyncrasies. But as an ardent fan and true believer, I knew more than most, including reports that Trump was a germaphobe. So I reluctantly offered my hand in reply as he gave me his power grip. "Don tells me great things about you," Trump said, as half a dozen employees of the company filed into the office and arranged themselves behind me, standing at attention. You do know I gave you a great deal on your new apartment, Trump continued. I blinked. I didn't know what to say in reply. This was Trump's first tell, if I'd had the ability to see what was unfolding, but events were moving so fast and in such a tantalizing way that I didn't have the presence of mind to consider what had just occurred. I had paid the asking price on the Park Avenue apartment. There had been no discount or special consideration. It had never even come up. But there it was. Within the first few seconds of our meeting, Donald Trump had lied to me directly, demonstrably, and without doubt. What was I supposed to do if I had possessed the wherewithal to gather my wits and take on the implications? Call Trump on it? The lie seemed silly, harmless, and childish, the kind of fib that was pointless to contest. It occurred to me that Trump might actually believe it, too. In a matter of a couple of sentences, with no conscious thought or understanding of what was actually happening, I had given my unspoken consent to start to play along in a charade that I would come to learn was all-devouring and deadly serious. For now, I parried with a joke of a kind. Would you like to buy the units back? I asked. No, no, Trump said quickly. You made a great decision to buy at TPA, just like you did at TWT. The blonde assistant entered with Trump's Diet Coke, and she offered me one. Trump took a sip of his soda and revealed what the meeting was really about. There is an issue I would like your help with, he said. I have a rogue board at TWT. We're in litigation, and they're looking to take the Trump name off the building. Trump smiled. You more than anyone understand the value of the Trump brand, as you own apartments in a few of my buildings. You had your parents and in-laws and friends buy as well, and you all have made a lot of money. Yes, yes, that is true, I replied. Tell me why the board is doing what it's doing at TWT. Trump replied by way of introducing me to the employees now crowding into his office. The top executives and lawyers for the Trump Organization were all in the room, and it seemed astonishingly that they were now to be put at my disposal. A perfect stranger to Trump, a relatively small-time attorney, and someone with no apparent connection to the matter other than my unit in Trump World Tower and whatever Don Jr. had said to recommend me. All of these individuals will walk you through whatever questions you may have and will provide you with any support you need, Trump said. I was incredulous, excited, overwhelmed. I was a graduate of the University of Western Michigan's Thomas M. Cooley Law School, perhaps the least prestigious institution in the nation from which to receive a legal education, and I was being asked to assess a serious situation and determine strategy on a critical business matter on behalf of billionaire celebrity Donald J. Trump? Don Jr. had evidently suggested that I might be able to help, but it appeared that I was being put in charge of a project that clearly was of great importance to the older Trump. I sensed that the issues involved had to be much larger than I'd anticipated, just as the opportunity appeared to be much larger, a chance I wasn't going to let pass me by. I had my own work to do back at my office, but all that could wait for now, however long this new venture took. Internally, I resolved that I was going to succeed for Trump, come what may. I will let you know my thoughts after I review the materials, I told Trump in a serious tone. Turning to the staff, I said, Is everyone ready to get to work? Trump glowered at his team, leaning back in his chair as my question hung in the air. I mean right now, I said. The yes, sir executives leapt into action. I was taken to a conference room, and I was soon reviewing invoices from Trump World Tower to see if there was any substance to the allegations of wrongdoing by the Trump Organization leveled by the condo board. With the Trump team at my disposal, I spent 6 hours that day and then the next 4 days in succession doing nothing but intensively searching the financial records. I was an attorney with an hourly rate, but payment was never mentioned, and I knew better than to rock the boat by raising the question of my fees. I calculated that working for free was a way to ingratiate myself and offer Trump no reason to complain or get rid of me. After researching the issues, I concluded that the board had indeed wrongly accused Trump, and I recorded that conclusion in a 3-page memorandum outlining the allegations, the controversial issues, and the way to proceed, as I saw it. The board was alleging false, petty, and disingenuous infractions, I wrote, and the real victims were the owners of the condos who were being forced to pay exorbitant legal fees to pursue a pointless feud. Worse, I concluded, the board had awarded sweetheart deals to landscapers for their own benefit. Finishing reading my memo the next day in his office, as I watched in anticipation, Trump looked up elated, as if he had finally been vindicated, and now he had proof that he was, in fact, the true victim. I knew I was trying to please Trump, but in this dispute, the billionaire really was being wronged, I believed. Over time, as Trump became a patriarchal figure to me and I fell under the trance-like spell of the real estate tycoon, I would come to understand that questions of right and wrong didn't matter to Trump in the slightest. All that counted to him, and then to me, was winning and displaying blind loyalty. "This bullshit can't stand," I said, Trump's chin tilting and chest swelling with self-righteous delight, and I, in turn, puffing out my chest in indignation. "I will lead a coup to take over the board of directors and rid the building of these animals." Trump leapt to his feet, exclaiming, "Michael, you're great. Whatever you need in terms of help, you got it. Go get him." Let me stop for a moment to point out that I'm not making up Trump's nearly constant use of the word great to make myself look good. That was how he talked. Hyperbole was his instinctual method of communication, exaggerating his own talents and wealth and physical characteristics and achievements as if by enlarging things he could make them real. The same was true for those around him, if you remained on his good side. I called it the flatter lie, the untruth aimed at inflating my ego, which I knew really wasn't entirely true, but that he knew I wanted to be true, so the dynamic was circular in nature and mutually reinforcing. I saw this all the time in Trump, as he sought praise and then offered praise in return, as if the act of bestowing his half-true approval lent the observation more gravitas. Huge, great, fantastic, the best. That's how he talks and thinks, like he's starring in his own ongoing major motion picture. With access to the Trump Organization's records, I had the contact information for all of the more than 300 owners in Trump World Tower. A small group of Trump's advisors and owners started circling the names of the owners we knew, including my parents and in-laws, and we started an underground campaign to gather signatures and proxy voting rights, the process rippling out as more and more residents heard our version of events and quietly agreed to support our effort to oust the board. Some of the residents were prominent, like the lawyer George Conway, the husband of President Trump's future spokesperson Kellyanne, but the effort was covert in the beginning, in order to blindside the board in the forthcoming condo board meeting. As the effort proceeded, the elder Trump displayed an intense interest in the matter, as he viewed the peril to his brand to be serious, and a variety of advisors and attorneys got involved, but I was the most avid and active advocate and point man. The turnout for the condo meeting in March of 2006 was expected to be so large it was moved to the Church of the Holy Family opposite the United Nations on East 47th Street. More than 300 people attended the meeting, with beefy security guards hired by the board of directors checking IDs at the door to ensure that no outsiders were able to enter. The room bristled with tension and animosity. Stepping outside with the line stretching down the block, I grinned in appreciation as Trump glided up in a black limousine right on cue, as if he were in the middle of an episode of The Apprentice with his executive team in two trailing SUVs. Also accompanying Trump was a gang of muscle-bound men looking like the forward line of an NFL team as the namesake of the building waved a hand and the bodyguards parted the sea of people, sweeping away the supposedly tough security guards the board had hired to prevent precisely such a show of intimidation. I was delighted by the performance. Watching the spectacle, all I kept thinking was that this guy's got game. For weeks, the board had planned for that moment, only to be completely destroyed by their opponent. That was real power, I thought. Not just physical power, but the cash type of power and the ability to mentally dominate your adversary. For me, this wasn't some event I was watching as a spectator. I was right in the thick of it. It was irresistible, intoxicating, thrilling. Inside, Trump saved me a seat in a pew next to him, a small gesture that defied belief to me, like I was becoming part of his intimate circle. Trump was agitated, angry that he'd been put to all this trouble by this ungrateful board of directors who understood nothing about real estate or the value Trump brought to the project, he told me. He waved his arms and expressed red-faced outrage as he stood and shouted out his indignant reasons for the board to be replaced and his fee to be paid, aiming his worst contempt for the chairman, a former executive with U.S. Airways, before it went bankrupt. "What does he know?" Trump bellowed. "He ran his airline into the ground." The crowd gasped in shock at Trump's aggression, but I loved it. It incited me to go even further. As I rose to speak, all eyes were on me, but the only pair that I really cared about was Trump's. "The allegations against Trump were false," I thundered, as the room began to stir in even deeper partisan division. I had prepared my speech in great detail, outlining the perfidy of the former airline executive and exonerating Trump. We had a stack of proxy votes we had the power to exercise, and the outcome of the vote was a foregone conclusion, but I poured myself into the speech. I had run twice for office, once for New York City Council and once for State Senate, both attempts dire failures, I'm sorry to say, but I had a taste for public speaking and the spotlight, especially with the admiring gaze of Donald Trump looking up at me. Then it came. The applause. "What a great speech," said Trump, offering the praise that I was quickly learning had an aphrodisiacal impact on me. "Man, you are a great speaker." Still worked up, I sat and took my printed speech from my breast pocket, autographed it, and handed it to Trump with a flourish. "Here, Mr. Trump, now you will remember me forever," I said. "I will," Trump said, pocketing the speech. "I will." A few days later, I received a package containing my speech, now in a gilt gold frame, with a note from Trump in his usual dense handwriting on the page, saying, "You are a great speaker and a great friend. Donald." After the excitement, days and weeks passed quietly as the renovations on Trump Park Avenue continued, and I wondered if I'd ever again have the chance to work for Mr. Trump. Then, one day, Trump's longtime assistant and occasional The Apprentice co-star Rona Graff called asking if I had time to talk to Trump. I did. Of course I did. I could think of nothing better than talking to Trump, helping Trump, pleasing Trump. "Michael, my man, did you get my gift?" Trump boomed on the speakerphone a second later. "I did," I replied, thanking him profusely for such a thoughtful gesture. We congratulated each other and ourselves on our glorious victory, the mutual reinforcement serving as a way for our newly forming bond to strengthen. "Listen, I need you to handle another issue for me," Trump said. "Actually, it's cleaning up a mistake Don made. Are you free to stop by today at around noon, say?" "For you, I will make myself available, I replied, again giddy at this further indication of Trump's belief in me, inviting thoughts of where this might eventually lead for someone who'd occupied the role of fan and onlooker to Trump, but was now on the way to becoming an advocate and intimate. Donald Trump just called me again for another project, I called out proudly to my younger brother Brian, also an attorney with an office next door, as I pulled on my jacket. Very nice, Brian replied sardonically. But maybe this time, see if he intends on paying you for your time. As I headed out the door, I had absolutely no intention of charging Trump for my time, no matter how many billable hours were consumed. I'd spent weeks on the Trump World Tower dispute and received no money in return, but I'd been compensated in an intangible way that was more valuable. I believed that I had to succeed completely and utterly to remain in Trump's good graces, and I knew I had to be on time as I again hustled up Fifth Avenue to the gilded Golden Tower. Trump hated tardiness, I knew, and I was going to do nothing to displease him. Walking into the fabled concourse for my new assignment, I was again greeted warmly at reception and on the 26th floor, now as a potential regular, a feeling I enjoyed immensely. Shown into Trump's office once more, I sat in the middle red velvet egg executive chair next to Don Jr. and an attorney named George Soriol, another young lawyer who had become one of the new members of the board of directors at Trump World Tower, like me. The Trump Organization's chief operating officer, Matt Calamari, was also in attendance, signaling that a consequential matter was at hand. I was given a rundown of the situation. Trump Mortgage Services had been founded in 2003 at the suggestion of Don Jr., and its name had been changed to Trump Mortgage LLC in 2005. But the enterprise hadn't proved successful, despite the housing boom then zooming along at supersonic speed. In Trump's telling, the whole fiasco was his son's fault. Don Jr. had brought him a shit deal, he said, and introduced him to a supposedly highly qualified mortgage broker named E.J. Ridings. Don Jr., who oversaw development and acquisitions for the Trump Organization, sat quietly as his father demeaned him. Over time, I would come to learn that his father held him in extremely low esteem. "Don has the worst fucking judgment of anyone I have ever met," Trump would often tell me, adding that he'd been reluctant to bestow his first name on his firstborn son. He didn't want to share his name with a loser, if that was what his son turned out to be. Trump Mortgage appeared to be an example of exactly that, a losing proposition that was tarnishing the Trump name. When Trump relaunched the company in April 2006 with a gala in the concourse of Trump Tower, he had predicted huge success. CEO E.J. Ridings claimed he had 15 years' experience as a broker and promised $3 billion in mortgages originated in the first year alone. Trump Mortgage would own New York, Trump said, and that in time it would dominate the country and the world. I think it's a great time to start a mortgage company, Trump had told Maria Bartiromo on CNBC only months before the global financial crisis struck, collapsing the market. Supposedly a great prognosticator, Trump had predicted, "The real estate market is going to be very strong for a long time," only days before the global economy crashed. I learned that the company didn't actually lend money. It was a brokerage that aimed to find clients and match them to banks willing to take on the loans. Hiring a group of aggressive salespeople, some rejects from other brokers with little background checking, the company operated out of 40 Wall Street, another Trump property. The Trump Mortgage floor was divided in two. On one side were salespeople devoted to high-end residential and commercial mortgages. On the other was a boiler room filled with high-pressure hustlers making cold calls to unsuspecting homeowners trying to convince them to refinance their mortgages. The kind of liar loans and subprime borrowers that were rapidly turning the mortgage industry into a toxic pit. According to what Trump now told me, writings had inflated his credentials as revealed in a Money magazine article that had just been published. Writings wasn't a top professional at one of Wall Street's most prestigious investment banks, as he'd claimed. Instead, he had had a 3-month run at Morgan Stanley with only 6 days working as an actual broker. But Ridings had fooled the gullible Don Jr. and, in turn, the elder Trump. The company didn't broker $3 billion in mortgages in 2006, nor did it manage the downwardly revised estimate of $1 billion. Only $25 million in loans had been originated. Brandishing the magazine, Trump again cast himself as the victim of other people's failings, particularly his son and his pal E.J. Ridings. I honestly didn't consider the possibility of Trump's own gross negligence and incompetence contributing to the collapse of the company as I sat in the red egg chair and listened to Trump, believing every utterance, or more accurately, not caring about the truth. Trump told me he had a job for me to do, and that was all I cared about. It was a strong-arm operation, it appeared. Trump told me I was to go downtown to 40 Wall Street unannounced and shut down Trump Mortgage. I was tasked with throwing Ridings out of the office, closing the business, and collecting all the files so that Trump's lawyers could start liquidating the company. Trump looked me directly in the eye. "Michael, this is really important," he said. "This guy is damaging the brand, and you of all people appreciate the Trump brand. Go do this for me and be rough. Be rough. And I mean really rough." Slipping downtown in Trump's ultra-luxury limo along with the attorney George Soreal and COO Calamari, I considered what Trump meant by rough. It was something like a mobster order, it appeared, an instruction for me to take matters under control and make it crystal clear to Ridings that the decision was final, non-negotiable. An offer he couldn't refuse. I also believed I'd been told to do it in as humiliating a way as possible. Not for a business purpose, of course, but for the pleasure of inflicting harm and exercising raw power. A cocktail I would come to find alluring. In fact, Trump didn't actually own Trump Mortgage. Like many of his businesses, there was a licensing agreement paying Trump royalties for the use of his name, a structure which shielded him from liability, but also meant he had no equity in the business. But I wasn't going to let legal niceties bother me. Arriving at 40 Wall Street, we made our way up to Trump Mortgage, where a crooked logo was hanging on a glass door. The COO Calamari was from Brooklyn with a thick Dems and Does accent, so he spoke first, instructing the receptionist to fetch Ridings immediately and tell him to come to the conference room. Now, as in right now. "It's showtime," I said, all of us now smiling. Ridings arrived, looking chipper and grinning. I ordered him to sit. "Michael is Mr. Trump's lawyer, as is George, and you know who I am," Calamari said. "What's going on, gentlemen?" Ridings said, the grin disappearing. "Nothing good," I said coldly. "Trump Mortgage is now closed. Mr. Trump wants all the files and records. You need to tell your staff to go home right now. They can take nothing except their personal belongings. Everyone is to leave except for the computer guy. Do you understand?" Ridings seemed stunned. "I need to call Don Jr.," he said. "Don't bother," Soreal replied. "Don't waste your time. He already knows. Mr. Trump has directed us to do this, and we don't want this to be harder than it has to be." But I did want to make it harder. Much harder. Some primal instinct reveled in the power I possessed, if only by proxy and proximity to Trump. "What are you doing still sitting there?" I demanded of Ridings, not allowing a minute for the new reality to sink in. "Get up now, tell all your employees to go home, and wait for further instructions." As Ridings started to argue, I departed to track down the IT person. Finding him, I demanded the password and login details for the server, which were given over reluctantly as the techie watched Ridings and Soriol shouting in the conference room. Fighting against an apparent coup de grace, much like the one I had orchestrated at Trump World Tower, Ridings again demanded to talk to the Trumps, which was agreed to. I knew it was useless. One thing I had learned from my limited interactions with Trump was that he is not a forgiving person. Once he sours on you, you are done. Watching the staff depart in confusion and disarray, Ridings was witnessing his world collapse by the fiat of a single man and his enforcers, which included me, with no right of appeal. The job done, riding back uptown in the limo, we giggled, recalling how hard-ass we had been to an essentially defenseless man taken by surprise and literally ordered out of his own business in an extra-legal and abusive manner. These were the permission slips I was starting to issue to myself. I was an officer of the court, sworn to uphold that law, which did not include staging a raid on a company and firing all the employees immediately and posting a security guard to ensure they couldn't return. Nor did I consider the plight of someone like Jennifer McGovern, a single mother of three who was owed $238,000 in commissions she had legally earned and which she has never received to this day. The liquidation was arranged to insulate the Trump Organization, no matter the impact on the completely innocent. And I was a willing accomplice. More, I was an eager participant. Back at Trump's office, Calamari told Trump all the supposedly glorious details about the encounter, aggrandizing how rough I had been on Ridings. Trump was beaming. Ever helpful, I then offered the password and the login digits for the server, advising that Trump should change them to protect the data and files. "Damn good thinking," Trump said. Praised once again, I was walking on air as I made my way home to the now completed Trump Park Avenue apartment, a short four-block jaunt. For a fleeting moment, I felt sorry for EJ, having his company taken away from him in the blink of an eye. But that emotion was swallowed up by the recollection of the day's events, Trump's accolades, and the completion of the task. Mission accomplished, I thought to myself, riding the elevator up to my apartment. I confess I never really did understand why pleasing Trump meant so much to me and others. To this day, I don't have the full answer. In a matter of a couple of months, I had started falling under the spell of Donald Trump. The question no longer was what I would do for Trump, the question was what I wouldn't do. And the short answer was that I would do and say pretty much anything. I had not only bullied a perfect stranger without knowing the complexities or legal framework of the dispute, but I did it with gusto and an utter lack of conscience. Filled with pride, I didn't wonder what lay ahead, or what other moral and ethical and ultimately criminal boundaries I would cross. Nor did I consider that Trump was testing my fealty and submissiveness, the way a gang leader assesses a new recruit, giving the wannabe small crimes to commit to see if he will act without question or concern for his own well-being. Donald Trump was like a mafia don, in a sense, and I wanted to be his soldier in the worst way, and I was ready to pass any test put in my path. Entering my new apartment on the 10th floor, I was greeted warmly by my wife, Laura, daughter, Samantha, 12, and son, Jake, 7. Eager to tell Laura about my heroic exploits, at least in my mind, I was shocked to see her face contort into a grimace as I related details of confronting and unmanning EJ Ridings at the behest of Donald Trump. As the rush of words poured out, her face crinkled into a frown, and she started to shake her head in disapproval. This mystified me as I continued to talk like a warrior returned from the field of battle, only to discover that what I thought was heroic didn't look the same way to Laura. I was at a loss for words at my wife's response. I thought for sure she would not only approve of what I'd done, but see it the way I did, as a triumph. "Your day sounds horrible to me," Laura said, my shoulders slouching in bewilderment as I discovered there was another way to view what I'd done that day to please Trump. Bullying people to do things was not attractive to her at all. She wasn't impressed by things like that. "When I started doing work for Donald Trump, I wanted her approval, but she wasn't going to give me praise for pushing someone else around. We didn't talk a lot about business and my work, and she let me go my own way. But I wasn't going to be admired at home for the things I was doing for Donald Trump, and I knew it." As our children grew older, they came to feel the same way. They would beg me to quit working for Trump, but I didn't listen. It seemed to them that I wouldn't listen to anyone, not even the people who loved me most, as I gradually gave up control of my mind to Trump.